here we go.
Okay, so what we didn't talk about is Jews and Christians in Arabia. Right? So let's do that quickly, and then I want to move along because we've spent really a lot of time on this. I'm very interested in that early period because it's so interesting. And it gives us kind of perspective on ancient Israel too, I think, which is interesting. One of the reasons why I dwell on that. Remember that the Arabia is outside the influence of the empires. And so, and I mentioned earlier that it was a place that attracted misfits. So what do I mean by misfits? In the Byzantine Empire had a vision of what it meant to be a true Christian was Orthodox vision that required a certain kind of Christology, understanding the nature of Christ, that was what aspect of the divinity of Jesus was, or what aspect of the person of Jesus was divine and what was human. And there were a lot of debates as to, because it became very problematic. So for example, if Jesus is God, then how could he be killed, right? Mm-hmm. But if Jesus is only human, then why is his message so transcendent beyond other prophets and other notions of prophecy? And so if he was, what does it mean to be resurrected? These were notions that hadn't been well established in the society and culture of Eretz Israel at the time. It was remember the notion of reward and punishment and afterlife and resurrection were ideas that aren't, or at least reward and punishment in an afterlife were not ideas that are biblical. These are extra biblical ideas. The only clear reference to anything like that in the Bible is in the book of Daniel, the very end of chapter 12. The book of Daniel is arguably the latest book of the canon. Mm-hmm. And there is one reference to a notion that maybe the righteous will receive eternal happiness after death.
Some people, I guess, would
say
that. Resurrected and judged.
Right. But, so these were issues that were being worked out, and the rabbis were working them out too, and that's reflected in the famous argument between the Sadducees and the Pharisees over Olam Haba. So, in any event, the bottom line became that there was so much dissent among Christian leaders that they were called together in councils to try to work out what is the mm-hmm. meaning of the divinity and the humanness of Jesus. And they still couldn't agree, and so they defined certain perspectives as heresy, and a perspective as being the true belief, which is orthodoxy. And orthodoxy was the only officially permitted view in the empire, in the Byzantine Empire. So if you didn't have that view, you were out of luck, and you could be persecuted for it, right? So communities of people who really didn't believe that, and that you can't, very hard to legislate belief, then escaped and went to other areas or campaigned against the Orthodox position. And if you campaign against the Orthodox position and you don't have the armies of the empire behind you, you're not in very good shape.
Slaughtered pretty
quickly. Right. So some Christian communities, non-Orthodox communities established centers in the Persian Empire and in the outlying areas of the Byzantine Empire that were not as closely controlled by the church. Mm-hmm. And they also established places in Arabia, it seems. So too, because Arabia was out of the reach of the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire for that matter. You know, the problem with being a Christian in the Persian Empire is that you are a suspected fifth columnist because despite the fact you might be persecuted terribly by the Byzantine Christians for your Christology, you're still a Christian. And so by the eyes of the Persian government, you are suspect because you might be associated with the empire. So that explains some reason for Christian communities moving into such an unlikely place as Arabia. Jews also had a similar problem. There was an orthodoxy in Judaism, a small O orthodoxy that was developing, and that was rabbinic Judaism. And the rabbinic orthodoxy's tower base was Babel, which was the Persian Empire. And so it's quite likely, although we don't have as clear evidence for this, that non-Orthodox Jews or some Jewish communities that may have felt that they weren't welcome or they may have been persecuted by the rabbinic community. Remember, the rabbis were really pushing to convert the indigenous Jews of Babel to rabbinic Judaism. Because rabbinic Judaism, remember, is an Eretz Yisraeli phenomenon. It's not organically Babylonian at all. Mm-hmm. The Babylonians were practicing some other kind of Judaism. And in the Talmud and in the Igeret of Shira Gaon, there is talk about rabbis going out to the provinces, Lahavitz Torah, to teach Torah. And it sounds like
Lahavitz
Torah, right?
The apostles. Yes.
They were out there missionizing. Yeah. Missionizing to the Jewish Gentiles, if you
yes.
will.
Chabad.
Yeah. And there was a complaint that the Jews in some parts of Babel didn't know how they kept mixing basar and halav, because they were probably practicing some kind of Judaism that was more true to the idea of lote v'shaviti v'chalev imo, not that you shouldn't have different dishes and you shouldn't be cooking them together and all that. So the net result of that was that Jewish communities, some scholars, some historians like me, believe that there were Jewish communities that fled that kind of oppression and went into Arabia. So the kind of Judaism that was practiced by the Jews in Arabia, just like the kind of Christianity that was practiced by Christians in Arabia, was not necessarily normative. And there's a lot of evidence, there's no question whatsoever that there were Jewish communities living in the Arabian Peninsula. There's even there's a place called Wadi al-Qura, the valley of the villages in which there were a lot of Jews. There was an undisputed very well-established Jewish community in Medina. Very well-established Christian community in Najran, which is south of Mecca. I have all this on a map.
Can I just ask, would that be also something where they went still further south into Ethiopia? Ethiopian Jews?
Yeah.
Jewry?
Yeah. Arabia and Ethiopia are separated by Bab el-Mandeb, which is this little strait.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of movement back and forth.
So what you have in the Ethiopian Jewish community would be remnants of...
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Not necessarily. I think the evidence is more stronger that the Ethiopian Jewish community was a Christian community that Judaized to kind of establish it. They pulled a Khazar move in order to be independent of other Christian tribal communities. They went back to Judaism. But they didn't know much about Judaism, and they didn't know anything about rabbinic Judaism. I think it's probably in the Middle Ages that happened. But I'm not sure. It's not clear.
Yeah, I read it. It was also the same thing I can remember.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Makes sense to me. Now, this is a great map, and it was supposed to be in the book, but it never got, they screwed up and forgot to publish it. So they didn't put the map in there. So if you can see this map, you can see, if you can, you see Wadi al-Qura in the north? I can't make it.
Yeah, here it is.
Okay, so that's where it says Jewish villages,
uh-huh.
Right? And Yathrib, Medina, big Jewish area. Here's Mecca. Najran, a big Christian area there. This is Himyar, according to, I don't know if I wrote this in the book, there was a Jewish king of Himyar in the 6th century, in the 500s. Is that right? Did you read that?
It's in the culture of the Jews.
And his name was Mr. Payas. Dunuas. And Du means Baal, or Ben, was associated with, and Nuas means long braids. So they think that might have been the first Yemenite with those cool long, the Yemenite look. And And so this is the Hejaz, which is the kind of mountainous area in the northern Arabia where the Arabs
where this is where the action was for the beginning of Islam. Yeah, so, and you can now see how close Jerusalem really is to this area. There's Gaza, Mecca, and the growing region for the incense down here in Hadramaut and Saba.
Why is Riyadh where it is?
I don't know why Riyadh is where it is. I really don't know. I've wondered that myself. Why is Riyadh over there? It may be closer to the oil fields. I don't know. There, by the way, was another in this side. You see Yamama? In this area is there was a counter prophet to Muhammad named Muslim. And Muslim and Muhammad were at odds with one another, to say the least. And they competed with one another. Muslim actually outlived Muhammad.
Where's Yamama?
Yamama.
Oh, I see. So yeah.
But Abu Bakr, the first caliph after Muhammad, killed Muslim. And they had a big war, a battle, and they fought each other. And it was the end of it. But Muslim apparently was a monotheistic prophet, too, who must be into something like Islam if his name was Muslim. And in Islamic sources, he's called Musaylima, which means little baby Muslim. Like, you're not a serious Muslim. So the Jewish community was... So what's important to remember is that there was a very strong Jewish community in Medina, about 200 miles north of Mecca, and there was a very strong Christian community in Najran, about 250 or 300 miles south of Mecca. So when Muhammad began preaching against polytheism, he alienated the big... the hoteliers of Mecca. May I close this now? Because it will just turn off after a while. And he, as he gained followers, he was increasingly threatening to the establishment, who tried to destroy him, but they couldn't really because he was a member of the tribe. You can't kill someone in your own tribe. You can kill someone in another tribe. You can't kill someone in your own tribe. You kill someone in your own tribe, you will be killed by your own tribal members. So they were kind of stuck. So they made his life as miserable as possible, and he had allies in his tribe. But he alienated a lot of people. And he finally had to find some refuge. And I wrote this in the book, I think. Did I?
Yes.
So, to make a long story short, he ended up in Medina, where there was an established Jewish community.
You had said if he had run south instead, he would have ended up in the community, in the Christian community, and it would have been a whole... So why did he run north instead of south?
There are two reasons, I think. One is that it was closer. And the other reason is because there was this opportune moment, there was politically an opportune moment to move to Medina. And I don't know if anything was happening in Najran. We don't know about what was happening in Najran. So in Medina at the time, there was a feud between two clans within Medina that was a blood feud, and they were killing each other. Remember, I mentioned that in the desert steppe, you could live in a blood feud for many generations and never kill anybody because you had all this great space. You don't run into the enemy, and you could avoid the enemy. Or you could have clashes, but they would be controlled clashes. So you can really sustain a kind of a war relationship for generations. But when you're living in a little village, and it was okay to do that. But if you're living in a little village and everyone is sharing the same water wells, the wells and water holes and paths and streets, and you keep running into the bad guys that killed somebody on your side, you're liable to get violent. And so there was a great escalation in the tension between these two clans. Same tribe, the two clans. Sometimes they're called different tribes. So it was at a clan distinction where they hated each other so much they may as well have been different tribes. And they when they went on Hajj to Mecca one year, they appealed to Muhammad to help them resolve their problem. Because he was known as a wise and honest broker. And he said, he negotiated with them, and he basically said, if you will accept me in my community in Medina, I'll solve your problems.
So they went back, and they went back and forth a couple of times, and they said, we will. And so he found refuge in Medina, and he did resolve their problems. And the way he did it was a very interesting way. He developed a system. Remember, he's a foreigner. He's not a member of the tribe, so he shouldn't be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
But he was apparently such a exceptional individual and such a trustworthy person and a compassionate person. You might not think compassion, right? Because he was also, you know, very just, as you could say. Mm-hmm. And in other words, he could be violent, but he was fair in the violence. He was within a culture of violence that he was welcome. And he insisted on a binding arbitration, so both communities had to agree to accept his decision before he even came there.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to accept his community and protect them. And so he came and he resolved the problem. And he resolved the problem by creating a kind of super tribe of Medinans where the different kinship groups had responsibility for certain aspects of their internal affairs, but the overall welfare of the community had to be determined by an honest, unbiased individual who was him, right, from outside. So he became the de facto leader of the community without taking away the status of the kinship leaders and the tribal leaders within the various clans. But of course, it did take away from their authority, right? So there was tension. He created this institution called the Ahd, the Pact, the Brit of Medina, which is considered by scholars to be an authentic document today. And it is really interesting. It refers specifically to the Jews of Medina and to the believers of Medina and the Muslims of Medina and the various tribal communities of Medina, and they're all part of the same community, and it's called an ummah, which is the same word as the word ummah.
Mm-hmm.
No, not am. Am is with an ayin, right? So this is the mother community, mm-hmm. the ummah. And in modern Israel today, when especially around Yom HaAtzmaut, people talk about ha-ummah, the nation.
Binyamei ha-ummah.
Yeah, Binyamei ha-ummah. So, and the Jews, it's really a brilliant document. It says the Jews have the right, same rights and responsibilities as the Muslims. And it says you can't, no one can initiate any kind of vendettas against people within the community. And you can't start wars with people outside the community without Muhammad's permission. And it was a system that tried to transcend the kind of internecine battles of the kinship groups. And it seems to have succeeded reasonably well. But there was a problem, and the problem was that was really kind of a religious problem. And that problem is that Muhammad was receiving prophecy, and he knew that he was a prophet. He came to and he wasn't accepted by his own kin in Mecca because they didn't like him, and he didn't want to accept his notion of prophecy. They didn't have prophets in pre-Islamic system. They had priests and people who could manage the gods, but they didn't really have prophets.
They didn't have oracles or some way? I mean, there must have been some way.
They had oracles, they had somebody, but they didn't have, it's by process of default that we don't think that they were so overwhelmingly not interested in him that it seems as if his paradigm was outside the natural paradigm of pre-Islamic polytheism in Arabia.
Right.
There must have been oracles. There were, we know. There were people that got messages from the gods. But they didn't accept him. And they didn't accept maybe it was his monotheistic father. That might have been the problem. In any event, you know, he was threatening their very religious identity and their livelihood by saying you shouldn't be worshiping the gods and you shouldn't be worshiping the one God and you should be just treating them well equitably. He expected that when he went to Medina that the Jews would accept him because the Jews knew about monotheist prophets.
Mm-hmm.
And they were monotheists. And they were ethical. And so they should accept him. But what he didn't know is that the Jews had decided a long time ago that there are no more prophets. Prophecy is over.
But what I remember learning is that there's. What you said before, he knew of all other of Jewish sources in Judaism, Christian sources. So he must have known that the Jews didn't accept Jesus, right? Even as a prophet. So why would he have been surprised that they wouldn't? I mean, obviously, why wouldn't he be surprised? But how could he not have known that was?
I don't think he knew Jewish sources.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think he had Jewish informants. He didn't. He's never saw a Torah scroll. He didn't know these things. He was living in Mecca. No Jews lived in Mecca. No Christians lived in Mecca. Christians lived in Najran. Jews lived in Medina. Mecca was a cult center for polytheism. No, good Christians and Jews wouldn't want to raise their kids in that town.
And they never, they weren't involved in the trade or anything.
They were involved in trade. They came through, and they brought their traditions with them. I think that my sense is that Muhammad learned about Judaism and Christianity because Judaism and Christianity became part of the common culture of pre-Islamic Arabia in folkloristic form. So there were stories about Abraham and stories about Jesus and stories about Moses that were part of shared culture of pre-Islamic Arabia. Polytheists, Jews, Christians, indigenous monotheists, they all knew about these characters, and they also knew about prophets named, old Arabian religious leaders like Hud and Saleh. These are also people that are mentioned in the Quran. And it was part of a kind of, it became an indigenous Arabian culture, but it wasn't Judaism, and it wasn't Christianity, it was a mix. And so what he learned about these biblical characters was not what Jews knew about biblical characters, it was different versions. So they had the same name, but they weren't the same people. And you can see that in the Quran too. The biblical Abraham is not the same as the Quranic Abraham, but not the Christian Abraham. They're different.
Well, but is that also because of the message of the religion?
Absolutely. It's also because of the message of the religion. But but the character who epitomizes the message of religion is portrayed in the classic source as epitomizing that aspect.
Right. Oh, I see. Okay.
Right. So, in fact, the Quranic Abraham and the biblical Abraham are not so different as they are, as the Christian Abraham. Christian Abraham is really different. Because Judaism and Islam are more similar.
Right.
In their notions of monotheism and notions of prophecy and all that. But they are different. So I don't think, and he didn't. There is a tradition that says that Muhammad went up to Syria. He was identified by a Christian monk as being a carrier of prophecy and all that. But that I think is a late tradition that was inserted into the tradition literature in order to counter the Christian and Jewish polemics against early Islam. So that's how I see it. I don't think he knew the sources. So he came and he had a vague understanding, and he vaguely thought that the Jews would accept him. But all monotheistic religions don't accept new prophets after they canonize their scripture, because that's a dangerous game. It's in danger of invalidating your own tradition.
It never ends.
Yeah, it never ends. So the Jews had to reject Jesus, and Jews and Christians had to reject Muhammad. Now, individual Jews could accept Jesus and become Christians. Individual Christians and Jews could accept Muhammad and become Muslims. But they couldn't be Jews or Christians and accept the prophethood of Muhammad. It's impossible. And Muslims can't accept the prophethood of the Baha'i prophet, the Baha'u'llah. It's impossible. You can't be a Muslim and do that. But he didn't know that, because he didn't go to school and study,
sociology,
religion. Yeah, history of religion. And so he was very profoundly disappointed. And one of the ways that the Jews, the Jews accepted him when he came to Medina, because they didn't know what they were getting exactly. I think this is my sense of things. And he expected to be accepted by the Jews. He was receiving revelation from God. The Jews, he knew it because he was a prophet. He was getting this revelation. Whether he was crazy or hallucinating or receiving true prophecy is a question you can't answer. But he knew he was getting it. He wasn't trying to fool anybody. The Jews, of course, knew he wasn't getting it because there was no more prophecy. So he was a charlatan or he was crazy, mm-hmm. but he wasn't a real prophet. So you have this like unbridgeable divide between the two. So from the Jewish perspective, when he was giving the revelations that he received, and those revelations included stories about the Exodus from Egypt and stories about Abraham, he was telling the stories differently than the Jews knew them from Jewish tradition. And so he was obviously wrong. Mm-hmm. But he was receiving them from God, so he was obviously right. Right? Mm-hmm. So how do you explain this? So from the Jewish perspective, he was an idiot, or he was a self-promoting person who was trying to get rich on unsuspecting, innocent people.
Possessed by a jinn.
Sorry?
Possessed by a jinn.
Yeah, or possessed by a jinn. Any of those options, right? That he wasn't authentic. And the fact that he wasn't giving the proper revelation was proof of it. Because we have the revelation. It's in writing right here in front of us. How could you, you know, look. They would go up to him and say, you don't even know what you're talking about. That's not how the story goes. The story goes like this. Right? So from Muhammad's perspective, the Jews are trying to discredit him knowing that he's a prophet because they know about prophets. And it's a cabal, it's an attempt to destroy him mm-hmm. and to destroy the truth of God because he's getting the real prophecy. So, and when they say that's not how Scripture is, they're distorting their own Scripture in order to disprove the truth of a real prophet, and that's the most insidious kind of behavior that a person could possibly do. They're destroying God's own word because they are politically threatened by the truth of the true prophet, right? It's an unbridgeable divide. It is, that's the sad thing. It's impossible to bridge this problem. There's no negotiation there. So it was a divide that could not be resolved. And the result was eventually a war. And they were all playing by the same rules because they were all Arabs. And they were all living in the same kind of social economic environment. You know, ancient Israelite environment was not substantially different than this. It was tribal. It was militant. It included fighting. It included fighting and warring. And when we Jews today apply our own, you know, 19th or 17th, 18th century Jewish ethical traditions of living as a powerless community in Europe, in the Middle East for 1,000 or 1,500 or more years, we apply that kind of idea on what these Jews were like in Arabia, you're just totally wrong. You just don't understand what was going on there. So you're creating a narrative, you know, you're applying your narrative to an environment that doesn't fit the narrative, and you're saying the Jews were, you know, peace-loving, negotiating types, and the Arabs were just Arabs. But that's not the way it was. The Jews were Arabs, and the early Muslims were Arabs. And they were using the same rules, fighting, using the same rules of engagement, the same expectations, the same form of fighting, and they were going to kill each other to the last man. And it just so happened that Muhammad won. If the Jews won, there would be no Islam. And Muhammad won, and there was no Jewish community in Arabia. So, right. So we get all excited about this and very exercised by this, you know, Muhammad killed all the men of the Jewish tribe, the last Jewish tribe to survive in Medina. He cut their heads off and buried them all in there publicly, a public spectacle. If you read the book of Deuteronomy and you see what are the rules of engagement for engaging in enemy tribes, and you were supposed to do exactly the same thing. You kill all the men, you take all the women and children as booty into your own tribe, absorb them into your own tribe, and benefit from that. It's just the same rules of engagement. So I get very upset, but it's very hard. I don't do it in public, because the Jews, you know, are not playing fair. Well, the Muslims are not playing fair either, actually, because the Muslim, so that you know the Jewish narrative. The Jewish narrative is that the Muslims are primitive, violent people who killed those innocent Jews, and it's proof that Islam is a bad religion. And look what they did to us. Shame on you. Muslim perspective is just as bad, and that is that the Jews were an evil people who knew that Muhammad was a true prophet, and they were so bad that they would go back on their thousands of years of monotheism just because they were threatened, and they were so interested in their own power and their own position in Medina that they were a lying, conniving group of scoundrels who cannot be trusted. And that becomes part of the Islamic narrative. And, you know, neither of them are accurate.
Together they make peace possible.
Yeah. But you see this as part of, you see this in, so we are familiar with the Jewish perspective, and so we can see, we can recognize that in among Israeli, for example, a lot of Israeli discussion about Arabs, and about Muslims, and about Islam. And how, you know, we are civilized people and they're really not, and they never really were, and they always were. And but we don't really know so much about the Islamic narrative, which is also a distortion. Mm-hmm. That, and it, from their perspective, they see Jews, Israelis, being, you can't trust them. They say one thing and they do another thing. And that has also happened politically, because it often happens in politics. You make a statement and then something changes, and then you don't fulfill it, and this is confirmation that the Jews can't be trusted. That's a big problem. Mm-hmm. So that's part of that. That's the narrative basis for a lot of the distrust today. Mm-hmm. Sad. So if everyone just would take a class with me, we'd solve all these problems.
Well, when I was living in Jerusalem, I took part in an encounter trip to Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. And we were with 40 rabbinical students, from very reformed to ultra-orthodox, people who would study in settlements. And beforehand, we got a training in listening. Mm. He simply spent 2 days talking to Arabs in Bethlehem, only listening to their story, without getting this kind of argument. It was a very, very interesting experience.
A student of mine, do you know Sarah Bassin? She wasn't in that. When were you there? What year was that? 5 years ago?
Yeah.
So you might have known her, because she was in that group encounter one year.
Yeah.
In, I don't know when it would have been, 6 years ago, I guess.
Yeah. Very interesting experience.
Yeah. She's now just finished and just got smicha this year and is now running a Jewish-Muslim encounter group in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. An activist, a group to develop Jewish and Muslim activists to work together on social justice causes as Jews and Muslims, as a kind of group. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting program.
Was it difficult?
No.
Really?
No,
he didn't find it difficult.
No, I think because that was our purpose. It was not to convince them, but to hear their stories. I think afterwards I also wrote an article about it for Leven Yotz Gelood.
If you have it, you could send it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Perhaps I even have an English translation, because Encounter published it.
I'd love to see it, yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be interesting.
Also from a Jewish perspective, for me, it was very interesting, because there I was on a bus with Jewish settlers, very right-wing Orthodox boys, whom otherwise I would hardly meet in the streets in Jerusalem. So on several levels, it's interesting to meet people. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the end of the Jewish community in Arabia, basically. Mm-hmm. Muhammad becomes more, his community becomes more successful, and they're attacked. There's some very interesting things that happen in Islam at this point. One is that as true to the old Arabian culture, it doesn't really matter. I want to move on, because we don't have time for too much of this staying in Arabia at this point. What I would like to do is to combat
yes, stop and start again.
Okay.